is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. It's getting to be that time to pick a peck of peppers. But if your crops aren't looking so hot, you might have a problem with blossom end rot. Today on our gardening show, we're going to hear how to spot end rot and what to do about it. Our experts also have tips about fast-growing veggies and what you should and shouldn't be doing in your garden as summer starts to fade into fall. Joining me now for our full hour of gardening is Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation, Corey Christopher. Welcome back, Corey.
Thanks for having me back.
Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director and Home Meadow Song Farm Co-Overseer, Peter Huttinger. Thanks for being here, Peter.
Yeah, good afternoon.
And Ohio State University Extension Educator, Eric Draper. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks, Lucy. Glad to be here.
Great to have you all here. If you have questions for our experts about your garden, and we know you do, give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Peter, it is pepper and tomato time. What are you seeing in your gardens?
Well, like we had mentioned in the opening about blossom end rot, and then also some people will have problems with both early and late blight. Blight is the disease, whereas blossom end rot is really a deficient. It reveals from a deficiency of calcium. Mm. But what's kind of interesting, contributing factors to both are high humidity, periods of extreme heat, and then where the plants dry out, and then a lot of rain. Mm. And so you get inconsistent watering, which puts the plants under a lot of stress. So it's kind of interesting. So there are some kind of parallels.
Yeah. We've been feeling all that. I read tomatoes described as garden divas. Would you agree with that? Do they react dramatically?
I like eating them too much category. I'm like, but there is some, you know, they can, you know, on a dime turn, things can go bad pretty quickly. But I think that one of the most important things for, you know, wind-growing tomatoes, and this applies also to peppers, is to give them plenty of space. Like we plant ours 3 feet apart. Some people will plant them 4 feet apart. We also train the trellis and or using a string trellis system. We train them to 1 or 2 liters to make sure that we have good airflow around them. With blossom end rot, you know, often that's something that occurs early in the plant's life and you'll lose the first couple tomatoes, but if you take those off and discard the tomatoes, and actually the blossom end rot's not poisonous, it's just ugly and unhealthy for the plant.
Talk about what it looks like.
Yeah, but you can cut off and eat the remaining healthy part of the tomato.
Does it look kind of like dark gray, squishy? Is that sort
no,
of what it looks like?
No, it comes at the bottom. It first starts to look, you'll start seeing some notions where it's almost like a bruise, a watery bruise, a spot, and then at the very bottom, it'll manifest and then expand up, and so that you have that. Now, if it's left on the plant a long time, that will kind of crack. It becomes juicy, and then it gets like mushy. Mm-hmm. But you know, you pull those off, and then you limb the tomato plants up. So remove the lower leaves, so there's a lot of space, so air can get underneath it. A good preventive measure in both situations also is mulch. Because in the case of blight, that keeps the fungus from splashing up onto the plants, onto the fruit and the leaves. And so that's a good measure. But even with blossom end rot, good watering practices, consistent watering practice, don't water the leaves any more than you have to. Of course, when it rains, that's going to happen. But to use water the plants at the base. Mm-hmm. One thing you can do to ahead of time is that when you're planting your tomatoes is to supplement the soil with some bone meal because it's high in calcium. And one thing for blossom end rot that you don't want to do is to add Epsom salts because that's actually magnesium and has nothing to do with anything.
Okay, so do a lot of people do that because they
hear,
that's what they should do?
When I first gardened, I did it, you know, and then I think it was Holly Ultrota Holcomb, who used to work with the conservation district, she's the one that kind of turned me on to some research that kind of discounted that. So basically, it's a calcium deficiency. And also, just in general, in our area, anytime we do a soil test in this area, we're very high in magnesium, at least any of the gardens I work in. I don't know what the geological reason for that is. So you generally don't need to add magnesium at any time to any of the gardens. It's the same thing with your soil pH. We have, there's a lot of limestone in the region, so you know, agricultural lime is just not, so, you shouldn't even have it in your garden shed. I've never seen a situation in southwest Ohio where we needed to add any kind of lime.
Yeah. Corey, you're shaking your head. Is there anything you wanted to add to all that?
No, I was just, the research piece I think is interesting because when it comes to gardening in general, just knowing that the resources are out there to tell you what you may need, like, you know, OSU Extension offices, for example, and just doing research, I think, is important so that you don't go down these dead ends that aren't going to get you anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, too, when you think about research, there's two parallel trains that support one of each other. One is university, sort of a more sort of like controlled lab experiments, but then there's the, you know, the kind of more practical experiential-based research that's done by farmers and professional growers. So I think, you know, certain books like the No-Till Farming and a lot of things that were published earlier by Rodale. In terms of fruit trees, Michael Phelps' The Holistic Orchard is a very interesting book where people are working in the field every day and sort of to practical observation and experimentation are finding solutions. And it's interesting that that's has really led us in many ways towards this whole movement of regenerative agriculture and this huge emphasis on soil.
Yeah. Eric,
we can talk about application because it's always interesting. It's all about what's in the soil solution. So calcium is really important for cellular development and building the cell walls of most of our fruit. And Peter's exactly right. The realities are, if you're not getting enough water on there, and when you ask people, did you water? Of course they say, yes, yeah, I watered. The question is, how much did you water? And an easy, simple test is when you're through watering, just dig a hole in the ground near the plant, within 4 to 6 inches where you watered, and see how far down that water went, that solvent front, how deeply that went. Many people think just standing, you know, hosing them down 3 to 4 minutes, that's not a lot of water. And if you have big plants with lots of fruit and plants require, that's a lot of energy needed and a lot of resources needed to ripen that fruit. Therefore, if you're not paying attention to water, that blossom end rot, which often looks like leather, like a black leather on the bottom of the fruit, that easily develops because you're just not getting enough water out there.
Hmm. Yeah, and that's interesting, too. And also, you know, kind of to build on what you just said is that, you know, when to water, you know, particularly if you have straw mulch or a leaf mold mulch or some kind of mulch around your plants, regardless what the plant is, that top layer may look dry, but it may not be dry underneath because one of the reasons you put that mulch on is to help retain moisture. So, you know, just stick your finger in there. And if you go down to your, you know, second knuckle and it's still dry, then you probably need to water. But if you stick your finger in there, it's like wet underneath. And I use that trick a lot, particularly when we're working in the community gardens, when people say, well, should we water? I say, well, let's look and check. Mm-hmm. And the same thing, the follow-up, I just then scoot some soil aside and see where you're at. It's a great, great thing.
Yeah.
Also with plants, too, it's kind of interesting because with tomatoes in particular, we're talking about divas, is that you can't over-fertilize them, and that can also exacerbate the problem with blossom end rot in some other situations because that has a tendency to spur on leaf growth, and then the leaf is taking up all the calcium, and the secondary, the fruit, you know, can be deprived of it. Mm. So there is a sort of balance, and because I've talked to many people, you know, I've used this, you know, commercial spray fertilizer on my plant constantly, and they've got huge leaves, they're green and they're beautiful, but I'm not getting any fruit, and it's because the plant is not threatened. I mean, it produces fruit to reproduce and to,
oh, gosh, okay.
Yeah. And that's also like with tomatoes, too. It's important to pick your tomatoes and peppers, particularly very early on, is get those lower fruit off because also that spurs growth and production. It's kind of like deadheading a flower. Mm-hmm. If you deadhead your flowers, they'll continue to grow more flowers.
Yeah. Got a full
You're suggesting we need to threaten our plants?
I do. They need a certain amount of intimidation.
Yeah, stress out those divas. We've got a full hour of gardening today with experts here to answer your questions. Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Eric, I understand some tomatoes and peppers don't seem to be able to set fruit this time of year. What's going on there?
Well, that's a fascinating aspect because there are so many things that come into play. But typically, this time of year, it's all about heat. And we have what's called blossom abort. What happens is the flowers themselves are not pollinated. And because of the lack of, it's the development of those seeds on the inside of that fruit that controls the fruit growth. And many times, especially this time of year, when we start having temperatures above 70 degrees at night or 90 degrees during the day, literally that fruit, that flower is not pollinated. And therefore, because it's not pollinated, the seeds don't viably become active in controlling the fruit growth. And it's frustrating for many people. They're like, look, I've got tomatoes earlier, but I don't have anything now. This is especially prevalent with bell peppers, that they seem to just shut down mid-season. Hot peppers, they don't seem to have the same problem. But a lot of it is simply what have been our nighttime temperatures and our daytime temperatures, because that affects directly not only pollen, but the actual pollination of those flowers. Literally the pistil, the female portion of the plant, can literally grow out of the end of that flower. In our solanaceous plants, tomatoes, peppers, they have like a little cone, and that cone, that yellow cone, is the male portion, the stamens. Well, the female portion will actually grow out of the end and be sticking out and not be pollinated. Now, yes, you can kind of beat the system, and you go out there and gently shake the plants, or the term I just saw and was fascinated by was bees create sonification. They create in their vibration, these bumblebees, when they come up, they literally vibrate, sonicate these flowers and cause the release of that pollen for the plant to then be, that flower to be pollinated correctly. So in this time of year, things get a little different. But if you're really having problems and with in the middle of summer not getting any production, there are what they call heat tolerant tomatoes. Things like Solar Fire, one of the more common ones is called Bella Rosa. That's the name of it. But they're heat tolerant varieties that it's not as critical for them. The question always is, well, how do they taste? Well, that I don't know. I know there is a tomato called Iron Lady, and I know that sounds good to you, Lucy. Iron Lady, and people say, well, because it's resistant to most of the diseases that are deadly to our tomato plant, things like early blight, late blight, septoria. Most of the diseases, it's called Iron Lady. Everybody wants to know what it tastes like. And I said, I've never found anybody that grew one that I could taste. So I really don't know. But there are solutions to most of the problems and creative ways to deal with that heat. But when we start getting temperatures like we've had, it's tough to keep them cool.
Yeah, I know. I, as a female, I don't feel like dating when it's that hot out, so I can understand those tomatoes and all those little parts.
And selecting varieties, like he was talking about. I mean, there are some, like Big Boy Beefsteak with the paste tomatoes, Rio Grande, Early Girl, which is a very traditional one, Jet Star. These are all ones that are somewhat disease resistant. Mm-hmm. But, you know, unfortunately, our heirlooms are the most susceptible, which have the greater flavor. But even some of these more commercial ones that were more bred, hybridized for the commercial large-scale farming, if they're grown at home or in a community garden or even a small farm and allowed to mature on the vine, to a certain degree before harvested and eaten. The flavor, like Celebrity, a lot of people say is, oh, that's a bland tomato. But if you go out yourself, it's a very nice slicing tomato, and you get a tomato that's with no cracks, it's perfect looking, you know, which is nice every once in a while.
Yeah. We do have a caller on the line. Hi, Tim. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Yes, Lucy. I have problems with my cucumbers and my zucchini. They'll produce great, and then all of a sudden they'll die on me. And I think it's because of vine borers. I don't think it's a wilt. I think it's a vine borer. Now, when I was younger, I used to be able to spot where they would, go into the vine at the soil level, and I could cut them out with my pocket knife. But now, as I've gotten older, I can't seem to find that entrance hole and do that. So I was wondering if there's a soil treatment that would be organic that would prevent them from, getting into my plants.
Okay. Peter, you have any thoughts for Tim?
Well, what you're talking about, like cutting the base or the stem lengthwise and digging out the grub, it's like a little grub worm it's white with a little black spot on its head, as one of the more effective ways. You can also, prior to there being borers, there's nematodes that you can inject actually with a syringe into the base of the plant, which is considered effective. I usually don't do that preventive. I look for it, but like you said, I'm sure you looked and you'd see like a little some yellow frass at the base of the plant, and that's where you would go into it. Now, if you have a vining plant that's going along the ground like a pumpkin, any place that vine re-roots is susceptible again to having borer enter the plant at that point. I remember one time we had pumpkins, and I think I stopped counting at about 45 how many borers I dug out of these things into the field. But if you're not seeing any stress at the base of the plant, it could be squash bugs, but it could be late blight also.
Okay.
Well, the reason I think it's vine borer, like you said, when they re-root, my cucumbers were doing that. They would die off, and then they would spread out and re-root, and I'd hit some more cucumbers, and eventually they would get in there also.
Are you trellising?
Am I what?
Are you trellising the cucumbers? Are you growing them vertically?
No, I'm just letting them grow on the ground.
Okay. You can get away with that if you live in Mexico or Cuba or South Florida because you have sandy soils, but you just can't do that with cucumbers here. Larger vining squash like butternut and so forth, you can trellis those, but it's very problematic. But cucumbers, you have to trellis, and that is probably, I think, if you next year or, put up a trellis and replant now, you still have time with the cucumbers. I think that's what you'd want to do, because I don't know anybody that uses that horizontal cultivation technique for cucumbers in this region.
Tim, does the whole plant die or just one part of it?
Well, with the cucumbers, they were, part of it would die, and then another part would start growing, I guess they re-rooted. And then it would produce a little bit, and then it would die. Eventually, the whole plant died.
Because with squash, with zucchini, summer squash, there's a disease called coenophora, which is, it kind of looks fuzzy gray, causes the blossoms to, literally, it affects the blossoms that the blossoms don't set, or as they set, the fruit itself just kind of sits on there, shrivels, and then drops off, does not produce. The coenophora is kind of, just think of it kind of like a gray mold, a botrytis, but typically it doesn't affect the plant overall. But when you start getting that collapse, by that I mean either one vine or part of the plant, that's typically suggesting there's a disconnect between the root and the shoot. And when you throw in producing fruit requires a huge amount of resources from the plant water, nutrients, everything. So if there's a slight problem, things tend to begin to wilt down.
Tim, I hope that helps. Good luck with those cucumbers. We appreciate your listening. Corey, I want to ask you a question before we go to break. Carrie emails, recently discovered a maple tree sapling was infected with anthracnose. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. All of its leaves turned brown and fell off. Then it grew a new set of leaves, but the same thing is happening to them. I was previously told to treat the tree with an antifungal spray in the spring, but should I also be treating it now? Do you have any thoughts for Carrie, Corey?
This might actually be a good question for Eric, too. That particular fungus, I don't know that much about it, but what I do know is it's typically not a health concern so much as just aesthetics. Eric, do you have any?
You're right, Corey.
Okay.
You're absolutely right, because typically when you get anthracnose, anthracnose is an early season fungal disease. So two things needed: cool, wet weather, and young, succulent tissue. Once the leaves fully expand, you're not going to get anthracnose.
And one of the things I've heard, and tell me again if this is wrong, that you know, a lot of people this time of year, if you start fertilizing some of your shrubs or younger trees, you know, first you don't want them to start growing leaves just before winter. I mean, we could get a really hard freeze again, but then if you are stimulating your plants to grow and put out more buds, you could actually make them more susceptible to developing it.
Is that what
as long as you give them?
No, I was just going to ask. She's asking, should she reapply an antifungal? Would that stimulate more growth? Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't think it would stimulate the plant to grow more. You could probably apply the antifungal if you wanted to. If it's a big established tree and it doesn't otherwise seem to be, you know, dying back, you don't have branches falling off, then, I mean, for me, I tend to I'd be patient. See if it's just something that's going to pass through. The winter may come through and it may not be a problem next year. If you start seeing large branches falling off, then you might want to think about some of the fungal treatments. Certainly if there are branches that could fall and, you know, land on something or someone, definitely get it looked at. But for some of those fungal infections, I tend to just sort of overlook it. And for if that is what it is, it may just be more of a, it doesn't look that nice, but it's not actually hurting the tree long term.
And honestly, it takes a lot. The rule of thumb that we kind of run in our minds is unless one third of the foliage comes off the tree and a third of the foliage, that's a lot of leaves. Yeah. Most start to panic. Well, I've got 5 or 10 leaves on the ground. It's okay. It's no big deal. But if until about a third of the foliage, it's not really a big deal. The tree can handle it.
And a lot of native species now with the heat, they're going to start dropping foliage. Some will start going dormant early just because it's so hot. So there's a lot of things that could be going on. I just say, you know, be patient. And if it's just bothering you because it looks a little ugly, you know, just squint your eyes a little bit and maybe try to live with it if you can.
Yeah.
But I'm sort of an under-treater versus over-treater for a lot of things.
Well, we'll be back with our gardening show after a quick break. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about gardening for the full hour today and taking your questions. My guests are Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation, Corey Christopher, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director and Home Meadow Song Farm Co-Overseer, Peter Huttinger, and Ohio State University Extension Educator, Eric Draper. We know you've got questions, so give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We did get an email from Tim, who lives in Middletown. Tim emails, we planted 100 Norway spruce plugs in the spring. We've been diligent in watering weekly. The needles are a pale yellow. Any need to supplement with fertilizer or wait it out? What do you think, Corey?
You know, this time of year, even our evergreens are starting to shed some of their needles. It's just a natural, you know, part of their life cycle. Spruce in general don't like heat. They typically like colder weather. I'm wondering if it was just how hot the summer's been that these seedlings just haven't been able to thrive necessarily. I would suggest, one, I'm not sure fertilizer would do much, and it could actually damage the trees if they are already sort of heat shocked. I'm wondering if you could even put some additional shade over the top of them, even if it's just, I've seen people hang fitted bed sheets with like the shepherd's hooks over some of their plants just to give them a little extra shade. So I don't know if fertilizer is necessary. It's hard to say. Eric, I don't know if you know of any particular diseases that might be affecting spruce these days.
Well, the first question that pops into my mind is, have you checked the pH? Soil pH, spruces tend to be, they like 5.5 to 6, they more acidic. So if you're in an area where the underlying layer, you're up around 7 or so, that could be a little problematic, but it would help just so that you're aware. I agree, Corey. I would not be fertilizing now. That would be the least thing I want to do, because it typically, as you said, fertilizers are salts. Salts and in dry situations, not a good thing. Therefore, I would say I'd want to do a soil test, see what the pH is, see if the nutrients are all there. And from that point, I think trying to shade, trying to help them, but this would be a tough year to put a plant in the ground if you weren't really paying attention to water and everything else.
Yeah. You know, I think just in general, when you're planting trees, shrubs, I mean, usually I would be doing that with like gooseberries or fruit trees, pear, whatever, is that, you know, I've really gone towards planting in the fall, you know, and when they're dormant, and then they have the cooler, more rainy season of the spring to kind of help their root system to get established. And so just as a rule of thumb, but also I think we should be mindful of the varieties of plants we are planting, particularly in the ornamentals. I mean, we're moving into an epoch where there's going to be warmer weather. You know, if you're planting a tree or any plant that's, you know, more inclined to wanting cooler weather, you know, we may want to, you know, step back and rethink that. So plant selection, you know, it's just like we were talking about varieties of tomatoes that are disease resistant. It's the same thing. Certain plants will do better in our climate and our changing climate.
Yeah. I'm a big fan. One reason I'm such a big fan of local nurseries, local growers, that you can talk to somebody to say, is this particular cultivar going to be good for this particular situation? And you don't get that in some of the bigger box stores. It's really those locally owned nurseries where people have that experience. So, you know, do your research and ask questions.
Yeah. Peter, you mentioned tomatoes, and we have a tomato question. Hey, Joe, thanks for calling. What's your tomato question?
Hi, Lucy, I appreciate you and your show, Cincinnati Edition. And I also appreciate what one of the people said about leaving plants alone, because there's another garden guru from another station that says that all the time. My plant is a yellow cherry tomato plant, and it's doing great. It's over 5 feet high. I've gotten harvested some tomatoes off of it already. Some are green on there. Some are starting to turn yellow. But the plant keeps growing, and I'm wondering if I should just trim off the new growth so that the old plant, the old flowers, and the tomatoes that are green now can have a chance, use more of the plant's energy.
Well, there's a thing you can do for pruning tomatoes, what you pin off is what's called the suckers. And so when the plant grows, when we're training, first of all, I want to say that cherry tomatoes are more viney and wild than other cultivars of the larger tomatoes. But you'll have a stem come up, and then there'll be a leaf branch that comes off, and then in that crotch, you'll see like a little, like almost leaf node or something coming out of that. When that gets to be about an eighth inch, you know, 2/8 inch or a 1/4 inch, you can just take and pinch that off. Because if you leave that, that'll become another branch or another leader. So you can end up with a cherry tomato. I mean, you can end up by 20, 30 leaders. So if you do that, particularly early on, and then you train your plant to have just a few liters, that will suppress the growth and allow the plant to put more energy to the fruit. Does that make sense?
In the world of tomatoes, that's called, we have determinate and indeterminate right. plants. The indeterminates, in order to get new flowers, indeterminates, cherry tomatoes are classic, and you need a new increment of growth to get new flowers. So if you want to have more flowers, they need to grow. And Peter's exactly right. You start pruning from the bottom up. You don't start at the top, because those indeterminates, and whether it's, you know, your cherry tomatoes or other tomatoes, indeterminate to get new flowers, which means new fruit, you need a new increment of growth. And so with determinants, the other type, they get up at a certain stage, they just start pushing flowers about 2 to 3. Typically, it's about the third or fourth set when they're just nothing but flowers. And that kind of slows everything down. But in cherry tomatoes, yeah, start at the bottom, work up. Don't start at the top and work down.
Yeah. Joe, does that help you?
Yes, it does. And I have one quick question about lantana. I bought two of them. I put one in a big pot on the ground, and it's doing great. I put one in a hanging pot. It's got a few flowers, but it's got a lot of flower buds that are not opening. What do I need to do?
Corey?
I always have lantana in a planter, and for the past couple of years, mine have not been doing very well. My experience, and it could just be me, is that they don't like the soil too wet, and yet when I went through this, you know, the recent sort of dry spell and super heat, mine stopped growing altogether, lost the blooms. I would say if they are in a hanging basket, they may have just gotten so hot, you know, hanging up, as opposed to having some of the cool soil on their roots. I'm not sure that that's the case with lantana, but I know a lot of plants, clematis, for example, is one that I always say doesn't like to have warm roots. So it could just be that having it in a hanging basket just made the roots a little bit warmer than normal. I don't know if that's just my guess.
Yeah. My research, one website said that lantana can handle drought, and the other one said, don't let it dry out.
Agreed, yep.
That's the internet for
diva.
You, Joe. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's just gardening.
Well, I appreciate your help. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks so much. Thanks for listening. We have another tomato question that I'm going to run by you, Peter. This person sent an email with a picture. Tom writes, I have landscape fabric under my tomato plants. Do I still need to stake them or put straw under them? Thanks for your help.
Yeah. Well, with landscape fabric, you don't need to put straw on top of it because that's a synthetic mulch. So, yeah, and that's was shown the photograph you sent in, and so I know that you have a commercial landscape fabric that's water permeable, so that's a good thing. But you do still need to stake them, because even if you're allowing them, I'd mentioned before with the cucumbers, if you're living in near the equator, they will cultivate these plants by letting them crawl on the ground. But here we just have too much moisture and humidity. So yes, you still need to, because if you think about it, even the water will pool on there, and also that black fabric will generate heat, and so you can scald the plants. But you know, definitely still need the trellis.
Okay.
Yeah, and you know, just with Eric talking about the indeterminate and determinate, tomatoes, I think that a strategy that a lot of growers do is they'll plant a mixture of both, because the determinate plants will produce all their tomatoes in a shorter window. So you have, and particularly if you want a can, that's good. Whereas the indeterminates have a longer period of productivity or production. And so you can kind of get this sort of the best of both worlds.
Yeah. We have Eric on the line. Hey, Eric, thanks for calling. What's your question?
Yes, I have a question about artillery fungus. We have some hardwood mulch that we put around our house like we do every year. And this year we have an invasion of artillery fungus, which shoots little spores onto the windows and the window frames and the siding. We took all the mulch out. I'm wondering if you have any other advice for how to manage that and to help it prevent from happening again.
Oh, man, Eric, that sounds unpleasant as heck. Corey, do you have thoughts on that?
You know, this is the first time I've heard of referred to as artillery fungus. And I'm actually reading now to try to figure it. So no, I know that, you know, most mulch you purchase, it's good to have, fungi in there. Like that's part of why mulch adds to the soil. It seems like this particular type of fungus though will shoot spores onto siding and things.
Yeah.
I don't personally know what you could do to get rid of just that one type of fungus without damaging the quality of the mulch and killing all the others. I tend to, if I'm going to mulch, go back to the same provider of that mulch time after time. But this particular fungus, no. I mean, OSU, Eric, do you know of anything?
Well, yeah. Actually, I can even give you, weirdly enough, I can give you, it's called a glebal mass. That little mass that they shoot, they orient themselves to the highest light intensity and fire that. Wow. This fungus is perfectly normal in a healthy environment. And we're mad. We're mad because we bring this mulch in and all of a sudden normal things happen out in the woods. They're suddenly happening in our landscape and we're mad.
I'd be mad. I don't blame Eric for being. I don't blame Eric for being mad.
Yeah, well, yes, I get that, but there's. I mean, they are tough to scrape off. They're tough to clean off. It's really a sticky spore mass. The realities will be that at this point, you pull the mulch out, but there's. It's just a normal, healthy environment. It happens in the woods, and we're angry because it's happening in our landscape.
Yeah.
Certain landscape mulches are not as prone, things like cypress mulch and things like that. However, there is really nothing that you can do to slow that process or change it once it begins.
I would suggest it's something that I think everybody needs to be doing now. Keep a garden journal. And write down what kind of mulch you used, where you purchased it from, how much you had. I mean, even write which plants did well in that mulch, which ones did not. And then next year, because everybody thinks you're going to remember this stuff from year after year, but hopefully few of us do, because I sure don't. And then next year, just don't purchase that same mulch and just try to avoid it moving forward. Because, you know, I agree, it is just sort of a natural part, and it's the fungus doing its thing. But if you're out there scrubbing with bleach water the side of your house, it can get pretty annoying, I'd imagine.
Well, thanks, Eric. We appreciate your listening. We appreciate your call. We are going to take a quick break. We're going to finish up today's gardening show. After that, if you have questions, now's the time to call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're in the home stretch of our gardening show. My guests are Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation, Corey Christopher, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director and Home Meadow Song Farm Co-Overseer, Peter Huttinger, and Ohio State University Extension Educator, Eric Draper. They're here for a few more minutes to answer your questions. Call right now, 513-419-7100, or email talk@wvxu.org. Okay, Corey, here's one for you. Diane emails, "We lost all our Colorado blue spruce trees to needle cast spore. Natorps advised we plant native evergreen species, so we replaced with Norwood spruces." Probably born in Norwood, Ohio. Just kidding. "The lowest level of these trees also appear to have signs of needle cast spore. What can we do to save our trees, and when is the best time of year to treat? Is it cooler fall months?" Corey, you have any thoughts on that?
I think she's still talking about Norway spruce. I don't know of a Norwood.
Oh yeah, Norwood. I was going to say that would be super local.
It would be very local, and it's not really native to this particular region. I for that particular disease, one thing that I always tell people is first, there's this wonderful thing called the internet, right? And so I Google every, even if I think I know, Google it. Based on what cultivar of that particular type of tree you have, it might be a little different depending on, you know, the weather at the time, what your soil looks like. Because I don't, I guess this is a good example. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. If it was me, I would probably pull up websites like, again, OSU has a great, a lot of resources online to help you figure out timing of that. But if whatever you need to purchase, if you're going to treat it with something, wherever you're purchasing it, the people selling you those products should also be able to tell you how much, when, things to look out for. So just sort of arm yourself with that information. Eric, I don't know if you have any particular experience with that one, because I just don't.
Yeah, actually, we know that of the two, yes, blue spruces are definitely, they struggle. Our soils are just far too warm. We see a continual loss of them across the state, even up here in the Northeast. That's a normal, because our soils are just too warm for them. Of the two, Norway is a much better approach, yes, but it also has certain problems. But I would not say that Rhizosphera, the needle cast diseases, again, the question comes to mind, how are you using them? Are you sticking them too close together? Are you cramming them together, trying to create a wall, an early wall between you and your neighbor? Because the more you keep that moisture in that base of that tree, that kind of favors diseases versus having that tree out more in the open. If you're looking to do a screen, stagger plant. You know, plant them 30, 40 feet apart, and then in the next row over, plant one between the two to create that kind of screen that you're looking for. But typically, the Norways are a much hardier spruce variety than the blue spruce.
And if you're going to treat, Eric, tell me if I'm wrong, but if she's going to treat some of these diseases, it could take several years. So it isn't a one and done. It might be a, you know, 2-3 years ever so often you're having to retreat.
Yeah.
Well, that is correct.
Yeah. I apologize for interrupting, Eric. We've got several emails and a caller on the line, so we're entering lightning round territory. Hey, Matthew, thanks so much for calling. What's your question?
Oh, love your show. I have some rambunctious squirrels down here in New Richmond, and I can't keep them out of my Romas and my jalapeno peppers. I have a little patio garden. I have a lot of sunlight in my apartment. In lieu of moving everything indoors, is there any way I could keep them out of it without any, like, inhumane, like, type of thing?
Okay. Thanks, Matthew. Any thoughts, Peter?
Squirrels are a common problem, and although I'm surprised, I've never had them go after jalapeno before. But, they often, with tomatoes, what they want to do is they take a chunk out of the side of it and they drink the liquid out of it. So, you know, we keep bird baths around that maybe help deter that. But we are at the East End Community Garden. We've had a real problem this year. And someone had donated a repellent, which is coyote urine. And I'm not saying go out and, you know, collect urine from a coyote. I mean, this is a product that
seems
you can
dangerous.
Buy.
Yeah.
And there are some other type of things that you can buy like that. But we use that. You just use very little, and we use that, and at least for the last couple of weeks, it's worked. Mm. So that's it. You can try putting bird netting over them, but generally they just get caught up in it and do more damage than not.
Yeah.
There are a number of repellents that I would suggest.
Okay. Thanks, Matthew. Appreciate your call, and thanks for listening. We have an email from Sam. I have lots of stinging nettles in my yard and garden. What's the best way to get rid of them? Pulling them only seems to make them angry, and they grow back more spiky and vigorously. Corey, you have thoughts?
If it's a problem with, you know, you're bumping into them, you're constantly getting stung, then, you know, you could pull them or spray them with a herbicide. You know, always read label instructions. If it's just a matter of, you know, some people think they just need to get rid of it because it's stinging nettle, I think they're really pretty. And you can actually eat them. You have to prepare them in a very specific way. But if you can Google that for recipes. I would say if you don't want to do manual hand pulling an herbicide that you feel comfortable with and that you're prepared to use would be the only option, unless you want to go to solarizing the soil, which would be putting a tarp over the area to kill it off. But then that would kill everything.
Hmm. Okay, we have an email from Lauren. We planted 5 beautiful spice bushes/trees. They were doing great, and now we have a lot of yellowing of the leaves. Should we fertilize? Is that something you can handle, Peter? Is that more of a Corey thing?
That would be Corey or Eric.
Okay.
I would say don't fertilize.
Okay.
Too hot, and with a lot of our natives, one reason I love them is you don't need to fertilize them, and especially now you don't want them to get really big and green and lush, and then suddenly we get a frost in October. That's just going to make them more susceptible to frost damage.
Okay.
The other question is, where did they plant them? Did they plant them out in the open? Because spice bush, Lindera. Spice bush is a half day sun, half day shade. It's an interior or edge plant. So if you put them out in full sun, Corey's right, you're stressing them.
Okay. We have an email from Naomi. Naomi writes, my lantana and black and blue salvia bloomed all summer last year in my balcony window box, drawing hummingbirds, bees, etc. This year, the stems of the salvia showed blossoms forming, but then they don't come to a bloom. And hardly any blooms from the, I think it says banana, but I think it means lantana. Any ideas? Going to throw that one to you, Eric, and you've got about a minute to answer it.
All right. I would say what she can do, more than likely it's something to do with botrytis, the gray molds that have just been shutting down. They, even though the blooms form, they never open. One of the things you can do is clean up, cut those off, remove the old one, the dead ones. And with annuals, contrary to everything else we've said, yeah, you can fertilize them, push them, see if you get more.
Okay, and we'll try to get one more email in. Jason emails, we are considering adding some black currants to our garden. We were looking specifically at the Benseric variety. Any tips or tricks when the plant matures? What time of year would the harvest come? We are typically out of town a lot in June and would hate to miss the crop. Do you have a quick answer for that, Peter?
Yeah, it's best to plant them in the fall. And they do bloom around June. We grow them at home, and we grow them in the community gardens, both the red and black varieties.
Okay, so
they do well here, and they do pretty good in part shade too, but they need at least 50-50 sun and shade.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation, Corey Christopher, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director and Home Meadow Song Farm Co-Overseer, Peter Huttinger, and Ohio State University Extension Educator, Eric Draper. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.